Welcome to the June podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pinchem. The June issue is on the topic of skull base CSF fistulae. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. Anil Nanda of LSU Health Sciences Center in Shreveport, Louisiana, speaks with Dr. James Liu of the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, Newark. They discuss Dr. Liu and colleagues' article, Surgical Nuances for the Endoscopic Endonasal Transpterygoid Approach to Lateral Sphenoid Sinus Encephaloceles.
Good morning. My name is Anil Nanda, and I am at LSU Shreveport, and I am privileged to talk to Dr. James Liu today. This is part of the neurosurgical focus on CSF fistula. In Dr. Liu's paper, which is Surgical Nuances of the Endoscopic Endonasal Transpterygoid Approach to Lateral Sphenoid Sinus Encephaloceles, has been selected for a podcast. So we're delighted to have you, Dr. Liu. If you want to start off, Dr. Liu, as you know, is at UMDNJ in New Jersey. Dr. Liu, you might want to say a few words about yourself, and then we can get into the questions.
Great. Thank you. I'm Dr. James Liu. I'm at University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, New Jersey Medical School in Newark, and I'm the director of skull base and pituitary surgery. And thank you for having me this morning. I'm delighted to discuss this topic.
Great, James. So we're going to get right down to the meat of the issue. So is there a diagnostic tree that you use for localization of CSF leak intraoperatively and postoperatively?
So when dealing specifically with encephaloceles or patients with spontaneous CSF leakage, preoperatively we get a high-resolution CT scan and oftentimes an MRI as well. And if there's a clear-cut defect in the base of skull that correlates with the laterality of their CSF rhinorrhea, generally, we don't do any further testing such as a CT cisternogram or putting pledgets in the nose looking for an occult leak. However, in patients where the defect is not so obvious and the leak cannot be reproduced in the office, in such as these cases that are low flow or occult, generally we proceed with a formal CT cisternogram where the radiologist will inject contrast dye. And we can follow the extravasation of it on delayed CT scan to see where the extravasation is coming from. And then from an intraoperative perspective, we generally put a lumbar drain while the patient is asleep prior to the surgery. And we like to inject intrathecal fluorescein, which is adapted from the protocol from Dr. Ted Schwartz's group that they published, which the formula is 0.25 cc's of 10% fluorescein mixed in 10 cc's of preservative-free saline, which is then injected back into the lumbar drain. We then place the patient in a slight Trendelenburg position to allow the flow of the yellow fluorescent dye towards the head. And then this allows us during the surgery to localize the direction of flow of the leak and also the site of origin. And oftentimes in these encephaloceles, sometimes you can detect more than one site of origin of the leak using this protocol. And then from a postoperative perspective, we generally pull the lumbar drain immediately after the surgery unless there was some question of the repair where we felt the repair was tenuous. And we generally just monitor at the bedside, testing them with Dandy's maneuver, Valsalva maneuver, and if the suspicion is higher, then we generally do a CT cisternogram. But generally, we don't use a lumbar drain after the surgery because of avoiding risks of intracranial hypotension.
Now, coming to fistula that are just postoperative as opposed to spontaneous, is there a specific protocol? Does it differ from spontaneous versus post-op?
Generally speaking, our protocol is slightly different. For a postoperative CSF fistula, these would encompass endonasal endoscopic cases performed for tumors such as a craniopharyngioma or a pituitary tumor or clivus chordoma. And if we suspect a CSF fistula, generally we'll test them at the bedside. We'll also do a CT scan to see if there's any pneumocephalus that has been progressive or has not resolved since the immediate postoperative CT. And in these cases, we generally like to treat these by early re-exploration. Usually these fistulas from, say, a transplanum approach for a supracellular tumor like a craniopharyngioma, these defects are generally large, and we consider these high-flow CSF leaks because there's been violation of the supracellular arachnoid and sometimes even communication through the floor of the third ventricle. So we feel that conservative management with, say, a lumbar drain could be potentially dangerous in that since the defect is rather large, you could potentially suck air and see tension pneumocephalus or even tension pneumocephalus within the ventricular system. And we've seen this and seen reports of this as well in the literature. So our preference is to go back and re-explore the repair and then revise it as necessary.
You know, it's exciting, these new developments with the endoscopic approaches. As somebody who's sort of an old-school person doing more intracranial procedures, is there any role for microneurosurgery and intracranial approaches for CSF leaks? I mean, I suppose you've had instances where they've failed. Or do you think that that is sort of an antediluvian or an obsolete procedure?
I certainly don't think it's an obsolete procedure, and I speak from a perspective where my practice is generally half endonasal endoscopic and half microsurgical for cranial-based lesions. And so I'd like to say I tend to have a little more a balanced approach towards things, but I still feel microsurgery is a very important part of our armamentarium for CSF fistula repair. And in our paradigm, the way we try to think about it is if the fistula is in communication with the paranasal sinuses and the defect can be seen on a post-op CT scan of the sinuses, I think the endonasal endoscopic is a very effective approach. And that would be our workhorse for attacking these defects. And I prefer not to have to re-enter the incision if necessary. If this was a fistula created from a transcranial approach, say a removal of a tuberculum meningioma where the drilling of the hyperostatic bone may have transgressed the skull base, resulting in a fistula. If the repair was inadequate from above, I would generally prefer to just fix it from below to avoid having to reopen the previous incision. But certainly when we deal with other types of CSF fistulas, such as the temporal lobe encephaloceles that present with sometimes CSF otorrhea, I generally think that these should still be repaired microsurgically using the classic middle fossa approach to repair the tegment defects.
The last question I have for you is, when you go endoscopically, what do you do about the sphenoid sinus in terms of physiological function? Do you just obliterate it or strip off the mucosa? And have you had long-term issues with that?
That's a good question. I would have to say in the past, historically, I would used to pack the sphenoid sinus with, say, a fat graft. And I think that comes from my background, my training. And now that I'm working with a dedicated endoscopic rhinologist, ENT doctor, it's a great team effort, and we're able to cross-fertilize specialties. And I'm learning a little bit more from their field. And so I've been influenced by him as a functional sinus surgeon to try to preserve physiological function of the sphenoid to allow optimization of humidification of air. And I've also come to learn that there is always a risk of long-term mucosal formation if we follow these patients long enough, if we obliterate it with fat, because there can be potential microscopic remnants of these mucosal cells within the bone, and as long as they're present, they'll have that potential to create a mucosal in the future.
Well, Dr. Liu, thank you so much. I'd like to thank you on behalf of our listeners, and I think this was very informative, and congratulations on your paper.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Nanda.
This concludes our podcast for the June issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Thank you for listening. Please join us for the July issue, when the topic will be Comparative Effectiveness Research in Neurosurgery. JNSPG podcast content is now contained in the newly launched American Association of Neurological Surgeons iTunes U site. Sign up in iTunes for our podcasts and additional content, including video content and podcasts from the AANS, all updated continuously. To read all the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery this week, or to listen to more podcasts, please visit us at www.thejns.org. You can also follow the Journal of Neurosurgery Publishing Group on Twitter and now also on Facebook.